Hello, everyone. It's Thursday. I had to look over there to figure out what day it was. Welcome to Lunch Talk Live here on NBCSN. Mike Tirico with you. We have a busy hour, an hour that's candidly a little bit all over the ballpark. Stephanie Ruhle, our friend from NBC News, who has a show on MSNBC, she'll be joining us to talk about some of the business aspects and the news aspects of what we've been discussing in the sports world. Jim Furyk, the terrific PGA Tour golfer, will join us. Mike Smith, Triple Crown winning jockey, will talk as we get closer to the return of horse racing. The Belmont Stakes is 2 weeks and 2 days away, so there's a lot ahead with that. And IndyCar is just a couple of days away from returning. Scott Dixon, perhaps as good as any driver in that circuit, will join us. So we're going to bounce around. This is a potpourri. If you like stew, if you like options, if you like a variable menu, this is the day for this hour of the show. Tony Dungy is our first guest, and he'll join us in a minute. First, the one big headline of the day that will be developing as the afternoon goes on is the National Basketball Association and the Board of Governors conference call, which, as you're watching live, is 28 minutes away. If you're watching on tape, it was 2.5 hours ago. 22 teams expected to be invited to return and resume the season in Orlando at Disney at the end of next month. 13 from the West, 9 from the East. Those who have a realistic chance to play for a playoff spot. Everybody plays 8 regular season games. And then if you're within 4 games of that 8th spot, then you're involved in some sort of a single or double elimination for that final spot, and then the playoffs will play out from there. So that's the plan, and the NBA owners expected to vote on that. That's widely what has come to the top of the surface regarding that. As baseball and basketball have plans in place, football keeps looking at training camp, and Major League Baseball still waffles somewhere between 112 games, 50 games, and some economic reality to what their season is going to look like if they're going to have a season at all. Time to bring in Tony Dungy, our colleague on Football Night in America, Super Bowl winning head coach, of course, Indianapolis, and his time before that, great head coach Tampa Bay, all of his playing exploits that we've talked about. But Tony is the voice of reason, to be really frank with you. For so many of us, at times of difficulty and times of trying to figure out what's the next step, what's the right way, we look to Tony so often for his wisdom and leadership. Tony, we started this conversation 6 days ago, on Friday last week, after everything that started to bubble up in a place close to your heart, Minnesota, where if you weren't with us, Tony went to college, still has family in that area. The week that has ensued has taken so many different turns. What has been the thing that is sticking with you the most as we try to navigate through this new series of issues?
Well, I think, Mike, it's what I said from the beginning. This has to result in a change of hearts and a change of attitudes. That's how this is going to be solved. It's not going to be solved by protests. It's not going to be solved by we're going to win the streets back by dominating the streets and getting people back in order. This is going to be done by a change of hearts. And the only way that's going to happen is communication, talk, listening, and trying to see everyone's point of view and saying, how can we come together as a country and make this country better?
And I want to get to some of the maybe how do we do that questions in a little bit. But let's deal with maybe one of the first examples of how we do that and how we educate and inform and also listen at the same time. Full candor, Drew Brees is a friend. He's one of my favorite people that I've covered in the NFL over the years. And a lot of folks have said that. Drew made some comments that were on TV yesterday and has since follow that up with a very lengthy apology on Instagram. I'm going to play you the comments, show you the reply from Drew this morning, and then Tony and I will discuss. Here are the comments from Drew Brees yesterday.
I will never agree with anybody disrespecting the flag of the United States of America or our country. Let me just tell you what I see or what I feel when the national anthem is played and when I look at the flag of the United States. I envision my two grandfathers who fought for this country during World War II, one in the Army and one in the Marine Corps, both risking their lives to protect our country and to try to make our country and this world a better place. So every time I stand with my hand over my heart, looking at that flag and singing the national anthem, that's what I think about. And in many cases, it brings me to tears, thinking about all that has been sacrificed, not just those in the military, but for that matter, those throughout the civil rights movements of the 60s and everyone and all that has been endured by so many people up until this point. And is everything right with our country right now? No, it's not. We still have a long way to go. But I think what you do by standing there and showing respect to the flag with your hand over your heart is it shows unity. It shows that we are all in this together. We can all do better. And that we are all part of the solution.
And obviously, as many of you have heard, from teammates to LeBron James to others, a lot came back at Drew with negative responses to those comments. Drew responded to that early this morning with an apology to teammates, City of New Orleans, Black community, NFL, went on to talk about missing the mark, comments being insensitive, not an accurate representation of what's in his heart or his character, and that he vows to be a part of real policy change and an impact that we'll have going forward on so many people, and how he's sick about the way his comments were perceived yesterday, but takes full responsibility and accountability. Tony, let me just get your reaction to Drew's words and then his response to those words this morning.
Well, as we said, we have to listen. And one of the things that I'm struck by, that's the first time I've heard the whole quote. And all I heard for many, many hours was just the first part. I disagree with anyone who kneels for the national anthem. So hearing the whole thing, I feel differently about it. And I'm a friend of Drew Brees as well. And I would love to have a conversation with Drew, and I think I will, and explain to him why I see it as proper. And I think a little differently when people kneel. But we've got to be careful. We don't let this whole thing get going in another direction. And we may disagree. Drew and I may disagree about whether to kneel for the national anthem or stand with my hand over my heart. But we agree on what has to change, and we agree on what we have to do to make our country better. And so we can't be afraid to say what's on our mind. We can't be afraid to listen and disagree and have a civil conversation and move forward. Yes, I'm sure Drew feels like he could have said it a lot differently, and he did apologize for that. And I respect that. And as a Christian, I think that's what we're supposed to do. We're supposed to accept apologies when they're given from the heart. And I believe this was from the heart.
And I'm glad that you pointed this out, Tony, because it was the same way I felt as our group prepared for the show today and played the lengthy soundbite. There were things in there that you hear that you don't hear in the responses from folks. Because Drew started by saying, what I say, what I feel, when the national anthem, he also mentions the civil rights protests of the 60s. This is not defending that Drew was in a space where, one, some of us disagree with him. He's not going to find a lot of the people in his locker room who agree with where his thoughts ended up. But there were parts of that that were said that make sense, that he was completely detached from when people were being critical. And the whole point is exactly what you just said. Nobody wants to listen. Everybody wants to take the soundbite and run with it as if they now have a piece that they can put on their side of the argument. And that's what's not going to get us any deeper in understanding. Where's the value, Tony, right now for all of us as individuals on every side of the issue? And this is not just the race issue. This is economic strife. This is cities. This is everything. The value of learning how to listen and civilly disagree with people and be okay walking away saying, well, you think that, I think that, that's okay. We can move on and not hate each other because we disagree.
Yeah, and when I hear the whole comment, I would love to talk to Drew and say, yes, I hear what you're saying. Now, here's what I feel when the national anthem is played. And yes, I had relatives in the military, and I understand all that. But this is not about the military. This is not about the flag. This is about something different. And let's have that discussion. And, you know, we can do that. And we've got to be able to do that if we're going to get this situation solved.
The Colin Kaepernick issue will continue to come up for many years and for a variety of reasons. And one of the reasons it's coming up right now, Joe Lockhart, who was working for the National Football League, formerly worked in the White House as a press secretary, he has come out now detached from the NFL and talked about some of the issues and why Colin Kaepernick didn't return to a team along the way over these couple of years. Do you think the Kaepernick protests are now being seen in a different light by people who maybe a year or so ago, 6 months ago, still thought that it was not the right thing to do at that time?
I absolutely do think they're seen in a different light now. I'm old enough to remember Muhammad Ali in 1967. And when he did not step forward and go into service, he was vilified. And many people thought that it was un-American. And then 5 years later or 6 years later at the end of the war, he's looked at completely different and became a hero for those of us standing for human rights. So I think the same thing has happened with Colin Kaepernick, and not just Colin, but all the guys who were kneeling. We, as we said the other day, we did some shows and talked to young men about why they were kneeling, what their purpose was, and it was beautiful. But now it's maybe being seen in a different light and maybe understood a little bit better, and that's what we've got to walk through.
Vic Fangio, the coach of the Denver Broncos, also made comments about his perception of where racism is in the National Football League right now. He's had to walk back those comments. We'll have to deal with his team in a different way. So, Tony, there are going to be toes stepped on. There are going to be feelings hurt. There are going to be players who you're asking to come together in the spirit of winning a championship and playing successful on-the-field football who are going to have some raw emotions shared. Yeah. How do coaches go about dealing with fractures in their locker room at a time like this, considering what the fracture is going to be because of the race issue?
You know, I've talked to probably 25 coaches during the last week. Everybody is on these Zoom calls now. They're talking to their team. They're having meetings. Probably the last 3 days, nobody is discussing X's and O's. Nobody's talking about off-season program. This is what they're talking about. And it has to be this way. And these coaches are saying, man, we've got to stay together. We can't fracture. We can't let this fracture us. There are going to be different feelings. There's going to be different ways of approaching this. But we're all on the same page. We want to see America better. We want to see the cities that we live in better. And how can we as a team stay together with different ideas, different backgrounds, but the same goal? We want to win a Super Bowl on the field. We want to make our city a better place to live off the field. How can we do it together? That's what coaches have to emphasize.
What about owners? What about Commissioner Roger Goodell? They're the ones who we look for statements, and maybe it's a financial donation here, but that helps. There's no doubt. In every cause, that helps. But the real action is going to be part of the legacy here. What about the voice of ownership and how important that is and what they say and do, more importantly, right now? And that's just not just football, by the way. That's every sport across the board.
I think that is so huge. And that was one of my criticisms during this whole kneeling process that we had a couple of years ago. I felt like, and I said on our show, if I was still in the game, if I was still coaching, I would ask our owner to come down and meet with our players. Let's talk about what's on their mind. Hey, if we don't want them kneeling for the national anthem, let's not take that 1.5 minutes before the game. Let's give them a platform. I'll give up 20 minutes of my press conference time. Will our owner facilitate that for our players and give them some time, maybe on our local TV stations, to talk about what's on their mind, why they're hurting, and what suggestions they have? But I think our ownership has to be involved, and they have to become part of the solution.
If you're sitting in that head coach's chair right now, do you sense that this is going to be a real major issue to deal with come the fall when we get to how will players react for the national anthem and how your team's going to try to find a way to stay together and still do your job while still giving everyone the space for what is a more powerful and louder voice on social issues than it ever has been for athletes?
I think it absolutely is going to be critical for coaches to deal with this. The talent doesn't win in the National Football League. Unity and togetherness wins. And so if you're not unified and you're not together, you're going to have a tough time functioning this year. So if I'm a head coach right now, that is the first thing I'm talking about with our players. How can we come together and be unified as we go forward? How can we have some action steps and some goals in mind? But let's not get fractured. Let's stay together as a group of young men wanting the country to be better.
And we talked about this last week, but those who weren't with us on Friday when we had the initial conversations, I'm thinking, Tony, about what the actual betterment of a city can look like with athletes who represent those cities. How can a player who may spend 3 or 4 years in Indianapolis or Tampa or Miami or Detroit or Los Angeles, how can they, during their time, use the fact that a lot of people know them because of the number they wear and the catches they make to make that city or their city back home where they're from a better place in terms of race relations and conversations?
So much of it is the emphasis that we put on it. And I know in Tampa and Indianapolis, we had a number of guys who did awesome things out in the community. And we covered some young men at different teams who were trying to be part of the solution and going and visiting police precincts and trying to pull teen groups together and visit there and have the police come in and talk to these young people. And there's so many things that can be done, but just using that voice and that personality, I think we're going to have a number of creative things that can be done, but it's got to start in ways that we can change hearts and we can change attitudes. And I can't wait to see what our players are going to come up with. I think we'll have some things that we'll really be proud of, Mike.
Can I throw this out there? I'm just curious, if I was somebody in PR or community relations with your team and I came to you as a coach and threw this suggestion out. So often we hear about players visiting with police, players visiting with teens who are in areas where there has been a high percentage of crime and trying to teach them a better way, a more successful way, a way to be law-abiding and contributing citizens. What if the players and their visibility and their star factor are used to speak to CEOs, CFOs, corporate leaders in those cities, and maybe help explain the gap to them because of their athletic prowess and their recognition? Maybe that group can message to the leaders of these companies who can lead their companies and the employees there to help make a better society. To me, sometimes those leaders going down to their groups might help build better communities outside of the teen group that has been in a tough spot in a tough neighborhood that we're trying to get out of crime's way and get into education's way.
No question. Those are the things that we have to think of. Think outside the box. And I know in Tampa, that is going on quite a bit. The Tampa Bay Lightning are doing a great job of trying to facilitate that. Derek Brooks happens to be with them. And so I get a lot of inside information from Derek. But just what you're saying, community, yes, government, but also our corporate leaders and trying to bring everybody together.
It's another step, and there are many answers out there. And I think the number one thing is to listen. And we love listening to you. Thanks for being so generous with your time, both publicly and privately, for so many of us who are friends and for coaches around the National Football League. We appreciate it as always, Tony. I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much, Mike. Great to be with you.
Always, pal. Tony Dungy, Football Night in America. When we come back, our friend Stephanie Ruhle from NBC News will join us. As sports restarts, there's a huge business and city component to all of that. We'll explore some of that with Steph in just a minute. Back on Lunch Talk Live, PGA Tour player Jim Furyk joins us ahead. So is Mike Smith, Triple Crown winning jockey, and Scott Dixon, one of the top drivers in IndyCar, all ahead. Still the sports aspects of the return post-COVID-19 and now all the protests that are going on have crossed over significantly into the world of news. And it is nice to return the favor here. Stephanie Ruhle, who hosts the 9 a.m. Eastern Hour on MSNBC, in addition to appearing regularly on the Today Show and Nightly News and every other broadcast on the networks, joins us for a little perspective from the news side of the world. Stephanie, we have had a lot of conversations about the economics of COVID-19 and how it was going to impact sports in our communities. And now the sports world is entering this latest conversation in the aftermath of everything that's happened in Minneapolis. From your chair, what are you seeing as the sports world is interacting with news in this very difficult topic?
Well, this very difficult topic and the protests, yes, they were started, they were sparked by the death of George Floyd, but they've also exposed so much more that has to get addressed. And it's around income and education inequality, right? It's about the last 10 weeks, the entire country has been on lockdown. And look at the jobs number. Today, another 1.8 million people filed for unemployment. So that's over 40 million people. And when you dig into the numbers, It is disproportionately African Americans. Do you know why? Because those people have lower paying, low wage service worker jobs. Between February and March, we saw 1 in 5 black women lose their jobs. This takes us back to opportunity, education opportunity. And we have to start addressing these injustices because in the last couple of days, we've seen a lot of influencers in the African American community speak out. And so many of them, as you know, are in sports. But the answer can't be that our influential African Americans only exist in the sports world, right? The executives, just a moment ago, you were talking about CEOs in America, right? They're the ones who are able to work right now because they can work from their home offices. We've got to address these income inequalities from the beginning because so much of this unrest is rooted in financial instability.
And Steph, do you think a lot of the unrest that we're seeing, and look, we can't conflate peaceful protests and looting because the looting's not right. I understand it's an expression for some, an opportunity for others. We can't define it one way. Do you think that a lot of this is that powder keg that has been built up over the last 10 weeks of lack of hope for the future, given what COVID-19 has revealed with all of the people who have lost jobs and lost some of the hope that they may have had living day to day?
100%. Before COVID-19, we had millions of Americans who didn't have $400 if they faced an emergency. And at the beginning of this, America trusted our leaders who said, we need everybody to stay home, not go to sports, not go to school, not go to work, because we're going to address this. And those decision makers went to their big, comfortable homes where they could get their food delivered. But think about all these people in America who don't go to great schools, who can't go shoot hoops, who can't even go to a park. We need that community. So we already were facing this tinderbox that was then ignited. And just think for a moment about all these places across the country that are getting hurt. And it does take you back to sports. It does take you back to colleges. Because in many, many cities, you don't necessarily have big business. So sports teams and universities are the business in those towns. So without sports existing, it's not just about the teams, the owners, and the fans like us who are missing watching our games. Think about all the ancillary businesses that are absolutely dried up that we're not even thinking of, and they don't come back until sports comes back and school comes back.
And let's take a deeper dive on that, Stephanie, because I'll put your senior business correspondent for NBC News hat on here for a minute. We are talking about return of sports for a lot of these leagues. And for a lot of the leagues, the return to sports in the postseason means their television money will be there and they'll be able to handle their balance sheets. But there are so many people who are impacted if we are 3, 6 months, maybe 12 months from returning to significant numbers of fans at sporting events. What is the toll that the businesses that live off of sports will have to endure?
Michael, it's so much bigger than we even realize, right? Last month, we know 5.5 million people in the food and beverage industry lost their jobs. So even when we do bring our sports back, you tell me, when is the next time you, Mike Tirico, believe you're going to be walking into a packed sports bar? When is the next time Ann Arbor is going to be jamming, crowded with people from a big game? You think it's going to be 2 weeks, 2 months? It could be 2 years. I know we all want to go back, but think about all of those ancillary businesses, not just the teams and the schools, all the trickle down. Imagine if you ran the parking lot outside an arena. What are you doing right now?
Nothing. You're not making money. Money's not coming in. Cars aren't coming in, and they're not coming in anytime soon.
What's it like in Ann Arbor? What's it like in Michigan?
Yeah, it's the same thing that it is everywhere, where people are wondering those hotels. Think of college towns, the 7 weeks a year that you have a football game and you have 100,000 people, 80,000 people. Those hotels, people who have gone to a certain school, they love to go back to their alma mater and visit. Those people are not planning those trips just yet for this year, and that's going to leave a financial void. On your show, you've spent some time talking to the people in the restaurant, food and beverage industry, and that does tie directly to sports. That is so much a part of the sports experience, watching your team as they are out of town or as you go to a game, going out for a drink or a meal before the game. Do you hear the restaurant folks truly concerned about a significant percentage of these restaurants never being able to come back?
Tom Colicchio believes this time next year, mm-hmm. we could lose 50% of the restaurants in this country. And just think about this. People could say, well, look at the stock market. The stock market is doing really well. Let's just clear something up. The stock market isn't just the biggest publicly traded companies out there. When you look at the stock market, you look at the indexes. And what are the companies in the indexes? The companies that aren't just surviving, they're thriving in the time of COVID. And I'm pretty sure as much as you and I could like to go to our big box stores and occasionally our chain restaurants, we love our local mom and pop restaurants. And if you own one of them, mm-hmm. you're not open right now. And of course, in the last week, we thought more and more businesses, restaurants would be open. But because of the protests, even that has gotten delayed. And you've got all sorts of restaurants that were already on the edge that have faced damage in the last week. We are in such a tender moment. And the really sad part about this connected to sports and restaurants, that is what connects us. Think about one of the few things that people agree on where there is a sense of community. It's eating together, drinking together, and enjoying sports together. And right now, we're losing all of that. And that contributes to the anger and the angst right now. So maybe all of this coming together right now is an opportunity to start to solve for this, to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and say, I miss all aspects of my normal life. What are we going to do to get back there?
And Steph, as we wrap up, we're 3 months into this pandemic now, and we've taken really a lot of the attention away from it because of George Floyd, the protests, and everything else that has gone on around the country with cities and curfews and you name it. But I feel like we've lost our attention on this major issue that didn't leave us. It didn't go out the side door and wash away. Do you think that as a country, we have to be bracing for, from the experts that you've been interviewing and talking to, some sort of a resurgence because of the protests and the things that are out there, and almost the reopening of America that's happened simultaneously to all these big gatherings?
Listen, we actually have to be aware of the potential risk at the baseline of hypocrisy. It was Memorial Day weekend just a couple of weekends ago where we were looking at certain parts of the country where people crowding at parks and pools and parties and saying, what are they, crazy? They're putting people's lives at risk. But now we also have people, and albeit many in masks, but who are out there in the thousands. Remember, tear gas was used this week. What does tear gas do? It makes you cry, it makes you cough, it makes you sneeze. COVID is transmitted through respiratory droplets. Now, a lot of us, all of us, have changed a lot of our behavior in the last 10 weeks. So we need to be prepared that we could see a spike again. But at the same time, regionally, responsibly, and using research, we've got to find a way to reopen. For us to just stay locked away indefinitely, that has a whole other cost to it. It's one of the reasons you're seeing all this anger in the country.
News has become part of sports, and sports has become part of news. It happens with more frequency and on a regular basis, and it's just great to get the perspective of someone who is so well-versed in all this and the business aspects of it as well. Steph, thank you. 9 a.m. Eastern, MSNBC every morning. It is my second cup of coffee every morning here in the office as I prep for this show. So thank you, Steph. Great to catch up. Stay safe.
Great to see you. I feel like we had a lunch date.
Yeah, we did. That's why the show is called Lunch Talk Live. A little live lunch chat without the food. Stephanie Ruhle there. When we come back, Jim Furyk. Ooh, lunch would be good. I'm hungry this morning. PGA Tour golfer, one shot 58, and now he's in the 50s in terms of age. I can't believe that. Jim Furyk when we come back.
That, to me, is the best thing that we can help John accomplish, was help him achieve that, the goal of winning a Super Bowl. Because I don't want to ever hear, I didn't want to go on for the rest of my life hearing, well, John Elway's a good quarterback, but he could win the big game. And if you know him, if you play on the field with him, your respect for him, that is what your admiration for John Elway is. Man, how cool would it be, how great would it be for us to help this man achieve something that has been eluding him for a long time, and that's what it was all about.
This one's for John. The Super Bowl 32, Green Bay and Denver, with a great retrospective as Liam McHugh hosts with Terrell Davis. We'll salute Terrell. That's part of Super Bowl week in America. We've been doing that all week here on NBCSN. Remember, Sunday night, Super Bowl III with the Colts and the Jets. A little inside baseball on the show here. Your producer will often ask, hey, can we run this and then go to the next guest? Can we make a transition there? And our producer, Brett, just said, hey, can we make the transition from that to Jim Furyk? And I said, yes, because Jim Furyk is as big a football fan as almost any PGA Tour golfer out there. So do you want to give me the hopes for your Steelers here this year, Jim? You want to talk Steeler football or Jaguar football near your home in Jacksonville?
We can.
Your call.
We can, yeah. you know, Coach Marone lives right down the road, so I now have to root for the Jags. Somewhat, but I'm still, you know, everyone knows I'm a Steeler fan at heart. I think it's nice to see Ben throwing again. And honestly, the Steelers have a lot of weapons. The defense looks great. I think, you know, if Ben's healthy, if he can get back to his old form, I think they have a good chance. Let's hopefully get to see football this fall, correct? Let's hope we get to see
it. I know, right? Absolutely. We are all hopeful for that and the return of all of these sports, including the PGA Tour. And here we are a week away from getting it on the tee for real for the PGA Tour players. First four events, no fans, starting at Colonial. Are you playing next week?
I am. I'm planning on playing the first three events for sure and kind of see how that goes. So we got Colonial, we got RBC Heritage, and then we got the Travelers up in Hartford. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, the Charles Schwab Cup is the event being played at Fame Colonial. We'll have it, the return of golf for you on Golf Channel 1 week from today. Jim, for you, this time has always been unique and different and handled by a variety of athletes in a different way. Did you put the clubs away at all for a stretch and start to get back a few weeks ago? How have you handled it?
I did for the first at least 6 weeks. Yeah, no clubs. Everything went away. I have a simulator at home. Mm-hmm. I have a little synthetic putting green in the backyard. I messed around on those a little bit. I worked on my putting a lot in the backyard, but no golf course. Our family just decided to hunker down, stay home. And, you know, the silver lining was some great quality time. My kids are, my daughter's going off to college this fall. So, you know, the time that we've got to spend at the dinner table, I think discussing the world, discussing what's going on, has been some good quality time. But the last few weeks, knowing that I had to get ready for Colonial, I had to get ready for the upcoming, you know, upcoming events. I've been back to the golf course a lot. I've been working hard. I think we are a sport that you can socially distance. You can play, you know, in threesomes and foursomes and stay more than 6 feet apart. And you know, I was nervous about it, but it's worked out so far.
You put this up on social media. This is so true, Jim, because I've played more golf in the last couple of weeks than I had for that same purpose. You can social distance very easily and do it, and you're outside. And a lot of pull carts for the younger ones. I'm still carrying my bag. I'm still carrying my bag on a hilly back nine. I got to tell you feel it come 17. There is a joy in going
straight.
Back to.
Yeah.
Go
I'm
ahead,
not
please
very
do.
Well versed on Twitter, so it was a little bit of a. I guess it was an experiment. I wanted to see, you know, what reaction there would be. You know, obviously it's Twitter, so there was some angry folks, but. I want to set the record straight. I don't care how you play golf. I don't care if you ride. I don't care if you push or pull a cart, carry your own bag. Have a caddy is a wonderful way to play golf. I'm just happy you play golf. I'm happy you can get outdoors, get some exercise, and enjoy some time with your friends. Putting a single strap on my shoulder is a preference when I'm carrying a bag, but that's just because that's what we did when I was a kid, and I kind of missed it. I enjoy I've played a lot of golf with my son here in the last few weeks, and it gives you, not being in a cart, it gives you an opportunity to talk to the folks you're playing with and kind of enjoy the walk. And I've had a lot of fun doing it.
And if you play with good golfers like me, it builds in even more social distancing. When I miss the fairway, it's two straps over my shoulder. And I'm headed off to the right where I've
there
sliced another tee shot. Jim, you know, you were a Ryder Cup captain last time around. Steve Stricker's asked you to be part of the team to help out as one of the vice captains for the coming Ryder Cup. And there's a lot of conversation. Will it happen? Will it not happen because of fans? How essential are fans and the presence of fans to the Ryder Cup as somebody who's been in the middle of 20 years of incredible Ryder Cup memories?
I think it's one of the things that separates that event from the rest in the entire world. The roars, the cheers, the, you know, the home and away matches that you don't see anywhere else. And the players just love that atmosphere, home and away. You know, I'm walking down the steps in Paris and I got booed the entire way down those stairs. It was about, you know, 400 feet. And I had a few folks apologize to me about it. I thought it was awesome. I mean, that's what that event is about. It's about rooting for United States or rooting for Europe. The players come together. There's battles on the golf course, but it's just a great part of that event. And it would be sad to see it, you know, not played with fans. But you know, that decision is going to be made here, it sounds like, in the next 2 or 3 weeks. And I'm as anxious as anyone. It's my favorite event. I love it. And you know, Captain Stricker's been working hard. I'm sure Patty's been working hard on the other side of the pond. And we meet a bunch and talk as captains. So you know, I'm anxious to hear what happens and how that decision comes about.
Padraig Harrington captaining the European side. There's been a lot of conversation from players involved on both sides that they'd rather see it pushed back a year to have the hope of fans as opposed to playing it in no fan or a limited fan experience. As you said, I think we're getting closer to something there. You have crossed the magic number here. You know, you shot 59. You shot 58 in Hartford. Wait, can I ask you this story? Is it true that you did not hit a practice putt when you shot 58 in 2016 on that Sunday in Hartford? How in the world did that happen?
You know what? I was kind of just in a good mood that morning. 29-day trip. Yeah. I was headed home. I was tired, had been working hard, practicing hard, not seeing a lot of results. And I just got to kind of shooting the breeze a little too much on the range with whoever was hitting balls next to me. And Fluff is kind of tapping me saying, "Hey, we only have 8 minutes to get to the tee." And he said, "Do you want to hit any putts?" And I was like, "No, I'll just go over there and rush and won't get anything out of it. You know, it's not like I hadn't been here all week. I know how fast the greens are. Let's just go to the tee." And, you know, it's a lot. I mean, it's what I do at home too. I go to the first tee at home at my home club and I don't hit a lot of putts, or I hit 15 balls and race over to the tee and go play with friends. So it's not much different than home, but totally a different routine than what I would usually have on tour.
That's crazy. So I mentioned the 50s. You have now crossed that magic number. You are ready for the Champions Tour. Will we still see you on the regular tour, Champions Tour? Will you bounce back and forth? What's the plan here as we get back to a full schedule, hopefully next year with Champions Tour?
So it was a lot more fun busting 60 than it was getting over the 50 horizon age-wise. I will say that. You know, my goal was to play the PGA Tour full time this year and that's kind of how I see finishing the season out. I'm excited about our start. I'm excited about the golf courses we're playing. They're places that I've had success in the past. Mm-hmm. But I do see myself playing the Champions Tour later on this year. Hopefully playing at least 2 or 3 events. My wife and I are now hosting a Champions Tour event here in Jacksonville, Florida, and that'll be in October of 21. I want to get out there. I want to see the guys. I have friends out there I miss. I want to see, you know, which events out there are most successful and why. I want to incorporate that into our event. And I think it's important for me to get out on that tour and see the tournaments because we're hosting one. And I'm excited. And eventually down the line, I'm not sure exactly when that'll be. I'll kind of, you know, I'll turn the page and I'll let that PGA Tour career kind of end and switch over to the Champions Tour full time.
Well, Jim and Tabitha Furyk have done so much for charity. Furyk and Friends has been a part of the North Florida scene for years here, and to have that as part of the Champions Tour will only enhance that tour and enhance the event as well. Best to Tabitha and the kids. Great catching up with you. Good luck back out there next week at Colonial, and we'll catch up here on the road.
I appreciate it, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Of course. U.S. Open champion from back at Olympia Fields, Jim Furyk joining us there. Triple Crown winner. He's won all the Triple Crown races multiple times as well. Hall of Famer Mike Smith is coming up when Lunch Talk Live continues. Well, Saturday would have been Belmont 2020. It's going to be running a couple of weeks, but on this Saturday, we'll air finally the one, American Pharoah's run to the Triple Crown. Relive that great moment, 4 p.m. Eastern, Saturday here on NBC. As we've been telling you, horse racing is going on around the country. It's a sport that has not stopped because of the pandemic. Horse racing's back. Bet the races from home. Visit americasbestracing.net. Now, a lot of horse racing involvement from home and around the country. It's going to just continue to ramp up as Churchill Downs open, Belmont's open, and Mike Smith is one of the names that is known at the top of the sport. America's top jock for so many years. As I mentioned, Triple Crown winner with Justify a few years back. And Mike joins us for a couple of minutes. Did you spend any time on a horse once from the pandemic hit until kind of returning here over the last week or so?
Actually, no, I didn't. We didn't get a chance to at all to get on the backside to even get on horses. But I stayed pretty busy. You know, I did a lot of road work and ran quite a bit and stayed on my bike a lot. And I have a little, they're called equisizers, a little, it's kind of a simulation of a horse that you can move its head and kind of balance on the saddle a little bit and rode that quite a bit. And that was about it.
I see that picture over your left shoulder of Justify. That was such an exhilarating run to be there in person and see the Triple Crown won just a couple of years after American Pharoah did it. For you, having won the Triple Crown races individually, to do it all together and be in that rare group, as you reflect on that, what does that mean in your career?
It means I could die right now and I would be happy, to be honest with you. It's life-changing whenever you're blessed enough to pull something like that off. It's still to this day the most humbling feeling that I've ever felt in my life. If anyone wants to talk about it, well, I'll always have the time.
It was a great day at Belmont. We go back to Belmont in a couple of weeks for the Belmont Stakes. What has it been like for the jockeys in the return here as more tracks have opened up and you get to be a little bit of a part of this? Does it feel any different? Obviously, no fans is a part of it, but what's been unique for you?
It is different. If you travel into another jurisdiction, another racetrack, you have to be separated from the other riders. So we've all tested and everyone's tested negative, but you still have to be separated. So if I go in to ride the Belmont on the 20th, I'll be in a separate room. So you don't get to see the guys like you normally would have. And of course, no fans. I can't imagine no fans being there for any of the Triple Crown races. That'd be sad not to have them. There's nothing like having the fans to hear the roar of the crowd. But other than that, it's pretty much the same, Mike. They've got all these protocols. They're running like clockwork right now. We're out at Santa Anita and everything's going wonderful here.
And at Santa Anita, they've set up in the parking lot kind of a restricted area, almost setting up a bubble for the jockeys. I hear you got a little glamping, a little glorified camping going on for a place to stay.
Yes, we do. We got, since they hadn't been able to make any movies, Santa Anita was able to rent what they call Star Wagons. So we all have our own little trailer that we have to stay in. It's really interesting when you get a bunch of guys around all living in a trailer. There's a lot of pranks that go on, and it's been actually a lot of fun. And we're doing good. We only have to stay in on the nights that we ride. Other than that, you can go back home, and then we test again a few days before we go back in.
Mike, the industry has obviously been through some difficult times here along the way. One part of the industry, the people who are on the backside who had to continue to take care of the horses during the absence of racing at many of these tracks, are people who deserve a lot of credit because they really helped keep the industry going when everyone went away. Can you speak to what the work of all of those folks, from exercise riders to grooms, has meant to the sport in the time that it was shut down in many places?
Well, they've always been the unsung hero, man. Without them, the game couldn't go on at all. But, you know, they all stay back there. They take care of these horses. They have a love for horses. They got a passion for our sport and the horses. And, you know, they've all done a great job of just staying in there with them, taking care of them. And everybody's been really, really safe. You know, it's been incredible. It's even brought us, we're kind of a family anyway, as it is. And it's even brought us all even closer together.
Well, Mike, I know we've got three Triple Crown races coming up, Breeders' Cup after that. So as you look out at the balance of 2020, it'll feel different in terms of order, but how about the adrenaline rush and what that will be like for a Belmont Saturday, for Breeders' Cup in that weekend? Do you think it'll feel like those important races have in a different way over the years?
I mean, it's still going to feel great to be a part of them. But yes, it's definitely going to be, you know, with no fans being there, it's not going to be as exciting. It takes that electricity out of the air. But, you know, you're going to get to compete. They're all in a different order this year. So there's going to be an asterisk by it. But I like to be the guy who won that, has that little asterisk by it. I still want to win all three of them. And as many Breeders' Cups
really
as I can.
Really easy to say when you've got Yeah, exactly. Well, when you've already done it once, the traditional way, if you can do it the asterisk way, then we'll know nobody will ever touch that record. Mike, I hope we get to connect with you before the Belmont in a couple of weeks. It's great to see you. Glad you're back on the track, and stay safe.
Thank you. Do the same. Thanks for having me.
Hall of Famer, 5,500 plus wins in his amazing career, Mike Smith. When we come back, guy who's seen a lot of checkered flags before anybody else, IndyCar driver Scott Dixon, as he gets set to get back behind the wheel in about 55 hours. All right, time to get back on the track for IndyCar at Texas. It happens in primetime on NBC, and it's the start of the season as well. 8 o'clock Eastern time, a pre-race right here on NBCSN at 7:30 Eastern time. Lee Diffie and the guys will be in Texas at the track to call the event. It is our pleasure to bring in the 2008 Indy 500 winner. Scott Dixon joins us now. And Scott, our friend Ahmed Farid, who we work with at NBCSN, has taken to the background battle, showing off the backgrounds that people have for all of their FaceTime and Zoom interviews. You win today. That's some pretty nice hardware over your right shoulder there.
Yeah, there's a couple of little trophies there. You know, it's nice. I don't think you can see the Borg Warner, but I'm very lucky. This is the only room in the house I'm actually allowed to display anything racing. So you can see, like, there's a couple of pictures and some trophies. So it's nice to have it in my little shrine here, you know.
Hey, if you're the five-time champ, show off the five time. Why not? It's with good reason, and it's been well earned over the years. Scott, for the uninitiated to IndyCar, returning to Texas, how does that add to the degree of difficulty of not having an IndyCar race since back last fall?
I think it's difficult for the teams and for everybody in the industry, but what's normal right now? You know, I think the biggest thing we've got to focus on is that, you know, we're extremely lucky to get back racing and the NTT IndyCar series, I think, kind of also in conjunction with NASCAR, you know, and they were kind of the leaders, I think, for a lot of sports leagues and entities, you know, to kind of kick it off. And, you know, it's gone very smoothly for them. We'll probably follow a lot of those similar guidelines, you know, throughout our return. Things will look a lot different. You know, none of us have been on track probably since February or March. It's a one day in and out exercise, you know, a short practice of qualifying and straight into the race. But it's definitely going to be very difficult for these rookies, that's for sure.
Yeah, there'll be rookies involved there, too. What a way to make your debut. So you're the guy who's won 46 times in this series, third all time. Also finished second, by the way, 46 times. That is reminiscent of that Jack Nicklaus record that we talk about in the majors. All the firsts, but all the seconds add to even the value of how great you've been over these years. If you could sit down with one of those rookies, how would you tell them to best prepare for what they are about to jump into, given the rust that everyone's going to have around the first couple of laps?
Yeah, I think we're very lucky. I think once you make it to, you know, this point of motor racing and you know, especially at the pinnacle with, you know, top three categories like IndyCar, you know, you should know what's required. But Texas is definitely its own beast. You know, it's high stakes, as it says right on the track, and you know, high bank oval. You know, a little bit of downtime out of the car. I think there's a lot of built up tension, right? You know, we almost started the season. We got to St. Pete. We were getting ready to go. And then, you know, a day before racing happened, we were set on our way. So I think it's more of just taking your time. You know, the race is still almost full race distance. It's going to take a little while to play out, you know, feel the car out and obviously, you know, be, you know, aware of your surroundings. And, you know, it's not just the drivers, but also the spotters and the strategy, you know, people trying to figure out and get their footing right as well. So there's going to be a lot of a possibility for a lot of mistakes to be made. You know, you just got to make sure that you're on the right side of safety as well.
Have the chance to spend some time at Indianapolis with Simon Pagenaud and Alexander Rossi, who were 1-2 in a very memorable Indy 500 last year. Just your sense as somebody who's been around and been so successful in this series, where the IndyCar series is right now as you get set to return to the track for some 8 races during this 2020 season?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, IndyCar, you know, as we commented on, you know, it's difficult times for a lot of people to know what's right and what's wrong. And even, you know, from state to state, you know, a lot of these, you know, rules and things change. I think, the NTT IndyCar Series is very well placed. You know, I think at the moment we're doing 14 races out of what was going to be 16 race season. You know, some of the venues we've lost, but we've added double headers. I think, you know, right now with, Roger Penske at the helm and taking over the series, and also, you know, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, we've got, you know, the best and the brightest leading us into the future, whether it's with, you know, OEMs and engine manufacturers to TV deals and things like that. So I think IndyCar right now is in a prime position to, you know, take a great charge and continue, the growth that it's had in the recent years.
You've won a race each of the last 15 years. That's a record. Obviously, there's a heck of a lot of talent in those hands and those feet. But what do you attribute that incredible level of consistency to beyond your talent?
It's a team effort. You know, I've never won any of those races single-handedly. You know, I've been very lucky to drive, you know, for, you know, one of the best teams in the business, and that's, you know, Chip Ganassi. You know, and he's probably the most competitive person I know. He knows how to get those right people to work together well. And, you know, all of us have been able to have, you know, these championships, and, you know, not just myself, but, you know, Dario Franchitti and, you know, all the great teammates of, you know, Dan Weldon and TK and, you know, Zanardi and Jimmy Vassar in the earlier days. So it's a proven team that wins. And, you know, Chip alone, I think, with the accolades that he's had and what's, you know, he's still pretty young for a team owner, the marquee events that he's run around the world is crazy. So definitely not me, man. Just proud to be a part of this team and proud to have the success that we've had.
Well, a lot of it is you. And speaking of teams, your team at home got bigger, a new child added to the team in 2019, a son to go with two daughters. What has the life of quarantine been like for you with a newborn for these last few months?
It's actually been a lot of fun. You know, Kit, who was born in December, he's huge. I don't know if anybody's seen, like, he's only about almost 6 months, I think, 5.5 months old, and he's the size of a two-year-old. So I think we need to slow down on the feeding, side of things. But honestly, he's been the easiest child out of the three. You know, he slept through the night from 8 at night to 8 in the morning from, you know, 3 months on. And it's been wow. Great. You know, I think for me, my off season was really busy. I'd done some racing in Australia, and then we kicked off with IMSA and sports car racing with Daytona 24 Hour. So actually the shutdown came at a great time to really enjoy that one-on-one time with Kit and obviously Poppy and Tilly as well. So it's been a lot of fun and I've really enjoyed it. But I'm also really missing racing. So I'm looking forward to getting going this weekend.
Well, you won your third overall Rolex 24 Hours at Daytona this past January, out of the car for a while, but back in there at Texas on Saturday with a busy day, but one day in and out. We appreciate your time and good health and good success here this season. Scott, thanks for your joining us here on Lunch Talk Live.
Anytime. I appreciate it. Thank you. See you soon.
All right. Scott Dixon joining us, as well as Mike Smith and Stephanie Ruhle and Tony Dungy and Jim Furyk. Busy day. A lot of sports, different types of conversation, and some good people to share it with. And we appreciate you joining us. Anquan Boldin in the National Football League has always been a very clear and loud and powerful voice among the guests with our friend Rich Eisen coming up next here on NBCSN. Thank you for watching Lunch Talk Live. We'll see you right back here same time tomorrow.